Welcome back, dear listeners, to another captivating episode of the History of Scotland podcast. For those who might be joining us for the first time, my name is Fraser, and I'm your guide through the intricate tapestry of Scotland's past. In our previous episode, we delved deep into the life of David I, paying particular attention to the intricacies of his family, especially the life of his beloved son, Henry, who has now sadly left this world. The tale of Henry was both inspiring and heart-wrenching, a deadly reminder of the uncertainties of life in the medieval world. But as we explored these personal aspects of David's life, we also waded into the wider narrative of the Davidonian Revolution, a series of reforms that forever changed the face of Scotland, setting the stage for much of what we recognise about the nation today. Today we pivot our focus slightly. While David's changes were sweeping, covering facets from governance to law, one area stands out for its significant transformation: the Scottish Church. The Church, as we'll soon discover, was a cornerstone of medieval life. It held sway not just over the souls of the people, but often over their daily lives and governance as well. David's reign saw a tectonic shift in how the church functioned in Scotland. But to truly appreciate the magnitude of his reforms, we need to first understand what the church was like before his ascent to the throne. How did the church influence daily life? What were its ties to the broader European ecclesiastical world? And how did it intertwine with the rules of the kings and nobility? But, dear listeners, let's not get ahead of ourselves. As with all tales worth their salt, context is vital. We shall commence today's episode with a look back at the Scottish Church prior to David's reign, setting the stage for understanding the monumental changes he would usher in. So with anticipation in the air, history's rich tapestry laid out before us, let us dive back into the reign of David I, focusing on one of the most transformative periods of the Scottish Church. Let the story unfold. To truly appreciate the evolution of the Scottish Church under David I, it's necessary to transverse deeper into Scotland's ecclesiastical roots, going beyond Malcolm Canmore and reaching back into the formation of Scotland's Christian heritage. So let's take a short trip back through memory lane of one of our earlier episodes and remind ourselves, how did Christianity come to the shores of Scotland in the first place? Christianity's footprint in Scotland can be traced back to the Roman times. The Romans, with their varied pantheon, were the initial bearers of Christianity to the British shores. In the wake of the Roman retreat in the early 5th century, the native Britons in Scotland found themselves in a mosaic of Celtic spiritual beliefs and Christian faith. It was in this atmosphere that the legendary St Ninian set up the White House around 397 AD in Whithorn. This was among the earliest known Christian churches in Scotland. However, the most significant wave of Christian fervour came from St. Columba in the 6th century. Landing on the Isle of Ona, Columba and his followers established a monastic community that became a beacon of learning and spiritual guidance, not just for Scotland, but across the British Isles. We also knew it as the resting place for a lot of the early Alban kings of the Kingdom of Alba. The first prominent figurehead guiding the direction of the Scottish Church during this era was Malcolm III, known more commonly as Malcolm Canmore as we know. As he ascended the thrones, the Scottish Church landscape was undeniably Celtic in nature. Its structure was rather decentralised, lacking the hierarchical order typically associated with the Catholic Church elsewhere in Europe. Instead, there were clusters of monastic communities spread across the region. The island of Iona in particular was a significant spiritual centre, its monastic practices echoing the teachings of St. Columba from centuries past. These monastic institutions were about more than just worship. They were essential community centres, often acting as hubs of education and culture in an age where such organised structures were sparse. It was against this backdrop that St. Margaret of Scotland, Malcolm's queen and David's mother, began her transformative journey. Margaret's background was a tapestry of cultural influences. Born in a Hungarian exile and neutered in the English court, she brought a cosmopolitan perspective to Scotland's ecclesiastical sphere. Passionate and aligning the Scottish Church more closely with the Roman Catholic practices, Margaret was behind the catalyst of the significant reforms in that time. She introduced many reforms, some as such the canonical hours, emphasising the sanctity of Lent, and fervently championed the Roman elegy over Janus practices. Margaret's impact was such that she covered the Synod of 1070, a significant event that aimed to realign and standardise the Scottish Church practices in accordance with the Roman norms. This synod marked the gradual phasing out of Gaelic Christian practices, bringing in rituals and regulations that echoed the broader European Catholic tradition. Margaret's vision wasn't confined to the mere religious practices. With her at the helm, Scotland witnessed the establishment and expansion of major religious centres. While Iona remained a beacon of Christianity in Scotland, new centres emerged, Dunkeld and St Andrews. These centres weren't just places of worship, they evolved as places of knowledge, drawing in scholars and thinkers, nurturing a culture of theological and philosophical discourse across Scotland. To truly comprehend the Church's role before David I, one must view it through the lens of an average Scottish peasant. Religion in this era wasn't just an abstract concept or weekly ritual, it permeated in every facet of life. The Church, with its festivals, rites, and ceremonies, provided structure and rhythm to the years. Saints' feast days were moments of communal gatherings, and agricultural rituals aligned with the changing of the seasons. Religious milestones marked births, marriages, and deaths. While the ecclesiastical elite debated the nuances of Celtic versus Roman rites, for the commoner, the Church's presence was more comforting and constant. They might not have comprehended the intricate theological disputes, but they undoubtedly felt the Church's persuasive influence, offering solace, community, and a sense of belonging. As we transition into David's reign, it's clear he inherited a church on the cusp of change. With the foundation laid primarily by his mother, Margaret, the cultural shifts she initiated, David was poised to introduce reforms that would leave an indelible mark on Scotland's religious landscape. David I's reign not only showcased an acute political acumen, but also highlighted his ability to understand the deeply entrenched connections between political authority and ecclesiastical power. Historically, the Church found itself at times under the influence of the powerful Archbishoprics of York and Canterbury. This wasn't a mere matter of spiritual domination. The Church's reach extended far beyond the confines of the sanctuary, influencing policies, land ownership, and more. Thus, when the Archbishop of York claimed spiritual overlordship over all of Scotland, it implied not just an ecclesiastical dominance, but also carried heavy political implications, such as a stance that threatened Scottish sovereignty, suggesting that the Scottish Church, and by extension the kingdom, was subordinate to English religious authority. David I, well versed in the intricacies of the English court, recognised the dual threat posed by the Archbishopric's claims. He wanted a church free from external domination, a vision that was not just about religious freedom, but also about the political independence of Scotland. Sure, this independence, it was imperative to counter the weight of York and Canterbury's claims. John Campanianus, David found an ally who was not only spiritually aligned with him, but also his political vision for the Scottish Church. John's role wasn't confined to religious rituals. As the royal chaplain, he was at the nexus of political and religious discussions. Recognising John's potential, David elevated him to the Bishopric of Glasgow around 1114 AD. This move was strategic on multiple fronts. With John at Glasgow's helm, the bishopric transformed. John brought in reforms echoing David's aspirations. Clerical discipline was tightened, religious practices were standardised, and there was a renowned emphasis on aligning the Scottish Church with the broader Roman Catholic ethos. However, the spiritual reforms, though significant, were just one facet of the renowned Glasgow bishopric. the real game was political. Under John's leadership, the bishopric began to assert its independence. It wasn't just a theological stance, but a direct challenge to the claims of the Archbishop of York. David didn't just stop at appointing John. Recognising the symbolic and strategic importance of Glasgow, he invested significantly in building the Glasgow Cathedral. This grand building was more than a place of worship. It was a testament to Scotland's ecclesiastical and political aspirations. With the cathedral at its nucleus, the Bishopric of Glasgow started asserting its independence. The battle wasn't easy. York's claims were persistent and had the weight of history. David, recognising the need for external validation, turned to the papacy. He sought to get papal endorsement for Glasgow and, by extension, Scotland's ecclesiastical independence. While complete autonomy from York's claims would take time and would be realised fully under David's successors, the path was unmistakably laid. David's efforts ensured that the church, a potential tool for external influence, became a pillar supporting Scottish sovereignty. In the annals of Scottish history, this chapter underlines how David I masterfully navigated the intricate maze of politics and religion, strengthening the foundations of the Scottish kingdom. Growing up in the Norman court, David was exposed to a sophisticated church system. He witnessed the benefits of a well-organised and centralised religious hierarchy. For David, this wasn't just about piety, it was about statecraft. A renowned and reformed church system could help consolidate the king's power, establish rule of law, foster trade, and integrate Scotland more closely with the rest of Christian Europe. Some of these key innovations were the establishment of the new bishoprics. David knew that to exert influence he needed to have trusted representatives across Scotland. By creating new bishoprics, he could appoint loyal clergy who would ensure royal decrees and religious mandates that were executed. Beyond the already existing dioceses like St Andrews, David created new sees, including those in Bethchan, Dunblane, Ross and Caithness. These bishoprics became centres of ecclesiastical and administrative activity, playing crucial roles in the governance of their respective regions. There was also the foundation of monasteries. Monasteries were not just spiritual centres, they were hubs of economic activity, learning and culture. They would play a pivotal role in David's plan to uplift Scotland's cultural and intellectual life. David introduced multiple religious orders to Scotland, such as the Augustinians in Holyrood. These institutions attracted scholars, scribes and craftsmen. They became centres for manuscript production and agriculture innovation, but also helped trade flourish under his rule. He also introduced the introduction of tithes. For the church to function and expand, it needed resources. David recognised the financial structure supporting the European church and sought to emulate it. David institutionalised the giving of tithes. Now a tenth of a person's produce was to go to the church. This ensured funding for church projects from building cathedrals to aiding the poor. And then finally, as we know, he standardised the church practices. A unified religious practice was essential for fostering a cohesive national identity. David championed the Roman Rite, effectively sidelining the old Gaelic Clwyd traditions. He established canons, introduced Roman liturgy, and revamped religious festivals and practices. The old Gaelic clergy felt marginalised as their traditions were replaced, however. Meanwhile, the new clergy, who were often of Norman or English origin, embraced and championed David's reforms, seeing them as a chance to elevate their status. The nobles, especially those with Norman ties, largely backed David's reforms. New bishoprics and monasteries meant more lands were under the church, and these were often administered in cooperation with the local nobility, strengthening their power. But the average Scot's religious experience transformed. While tithing was an additional burden, the establishment of local parishes and churches meant better access to religious services and community gatherings. The monasteries also aided the local economies, offering jobs and spurring on trade. Monasticism is derived from the word term monos, which means alone in Greek. It's a way of life where individuals separate themselves from society to focus on spiritual growth and devotion. Originating in the East, monastic practices would find their way to the West, ever shaping the religious landscape. But what was the essence of this newfound way of living? Well, monks and nuns aimed for a life that was abstaining from worldly pleasures and personal desires to achieve spiritual purity. This often includes periods of fasting, silence, and continuous prayer. Communal living, while some monks led hermit-like existences, many lived in communities abiding by a shared rule of life, emphasizing poverty, chastity, and obedience. But David's reign marked an era where the church played a significant role in shaping the political, cultural, and social facets of Scotland. So Scotland's monastic lumery, founding and amplifying monastic communities, David didn't just establish these new monastic houses. He amplified and enriched pre-existing ones, ensuring their influence reached far and wide. Institutions like the Cilister Clan House in Melrose weren't just religious centres, but became bustling communities supporting craftsmen, labourers and scholars. David's travels and connections with mainland Europe brought the ideals and structures of continental monasticism to Scotland. He integrated the reformed European monastic movements with the traditional Celtic practices, creating a unique blend of religious fervour. David's gifts to these religious houses weren't just restricted to lands. He bestowed titles, granted fishing rights, and offered tax reliefs. Such acts made these monasteries economically self-sufficient, allowing them to flourish. The depth of David's devotion can be gauged from his personal visits to these establishments. He would often retreat to these spiritual sanctuaries for introspection and, especially during Lent, head to St. Andrew's. But David's monasteries were more than just places of worship, as I've said. They've become centres of enlightenment, housing valuable manuscripts and promoting studies in theology, philosophy, and even medicine. These monasteries under David turned into thriving economic hubs. By introducing advanced European agricultural techniques, they enhanced local farming practices. Their land produced grains, wines, and other goods which were then traded, boosting local economies. The monastic communities played a pivotal role in reinforcing Christian values among the populace. They became centres for pilgrimage, attracting both the nobility and commoners, fostering a shared sense of spiritual purpose. David's monastic reforms were not just insular, they linked Scotland to the broader European Christian community, fostering relationships, trade, and cultural exchange. In essence, under David I, Scotland underwent a transformation that had enduring social and economic and spiritual implications. These monasteries were no longer just secluded religious houses. They became vital centres of Scottish medieval life. But as we delve into the realm of the ecclesiastical disputes during David I's reign, it's crucial to understand the backdrop. David I's reforms were undeniably transformative, but with change often comes friction. So let's break that down. Imagine the introduction of a new religious houses and dioceses. These fresh establishments sometimes overlapped with existing territories, creating a battle over land and influence. Picture the disputes that would arise from this, with each side claiming divine right. The archbishops of York and Canterbury were not just mere religious figures as we know, they wielded significant power on the British continent. They viewed Scotland as their domain, religiously speaking. But David, ever the visionary, contested this, wanting a Scottish church free from the English religious dominion. But delving deeper, we find that customary rites became another bone of contention. Traditional practices, especially when it came to land grants and tithes to the church, were now under scrutiny. Think of the friction between the crown and the local religious leaders, as each side clung to their interpretations. But David was able to navigate the storm. He was more than a king, he was a diplomat, and instead of brute force, he'd convened synods, gathering church leaders to discuss, debate, and deliberate on issues. This method often led to peaceful resolutions that were acceptable to all parties. But David was also meticulous. To stamp out any ambiguity, he ensured religious institutions had their rights and privileges clearly laid out in royal charters. This way, everyone knew where they stood. Enter John Campanius, He's a figure that looms large, as we know. John wasn't just a religious figure, he was the mediator and a voice of reason on David's side. He was often the bridge between the varying factions, bringing scriptural perspectives and a common presence to these heated disputes. Now, picturing David, it's essential to see him not as an aggressor, but as a reformer, with purpose. He was assertive when required, but rarely hostile. Instead, he blended the patience, negotiation, and at times the firm assertion of the royal prerogative, but he always kept his reforms aligned with Christian tenets. But there is one man in the Christian world that we haven't spoke about in terms of how he viewed any of these changes. The Pope wasn't just a distant figure in Rome, he played an influential role in these disputes. David, fully aware of this, often sought papal involvement. When a matter was particularly contentious, David would turn to Rome, seeking a papal bull. These decrees from the Pope held immense weight and could validate David's reforms. At times, the Pope would dispatch legates to Scotland, either to mediate in these disputes or to understand the situation firsthand. The papacy was in a delicate position. They recognised David's commitment to reforms, but also had to navigate the politics between England and Scotland. One of the first problems David had to deal with as king was an ecclesiastical dispute with the English Church. This issue, as we know, was the Scottish sees to be under the power of the Archbishops of York and/or Canterbury, and an issue which, since his election in 1124, had prevented Robert of Scone from being consecrated. It is likely that since the 11th century, the bishopric of St. Andrews functioned as a de facto. In the recently recovered last 20% of the version A of the St. Andrews Foundation legend, a text composed of the turn of the 11th and 12th centuries, some of the contemporary clerics at the bishopric of St. Andrews were mentioned by name, and one of these were Archbishop Giric, referring to Bishop Giric. Bishop Fothad II, upon his death in 1093 AD, was recorded in the Annals of Ulster as Fothad Archbishop Albion. This is Fothad Archbishop of Scotland. The problem was that this archbishopric status had not been cleared with the papacy, opening up the way for the English archbishops to claim overlordship of the whole of the Scottish Church. The man responsible was the new, aggressively assertive Archbishop of York, Thurston. In 1125, Thurston once again went on the offensive. In this year, Pope Horanus II wrote to David and ordered him to receive his legate, John de Cremer, and to cause all the bishops of thy land to assemble to his council when they are summoned by him. The controversies which they have long been kept up between Thurston, Archbishop of York, and the bishops of thy land, we commit this our legate to be very carefully investigated and discussed, but we reserve the final decision for the judgment of our apostolic see. No legatine council, however, took place, and legate John de Cremer headed back through southern England. The legate was charged with investigating the historical and political status of the bishoprics of Scotland proper, the lands north of the River Forth. However, such investigation was not needed for the two bishoprics south of the Forth. In the same year, the Pope wrote to John, Bishop of Glasgow, and Gael Aidan, Bishop of Galloway, ordering them to submit to the Archbishop of York. As the former was part of David's dominion, this was not the news David would have wanted. David ordered Bishop John of Glasgow to travel to the Apostolic See in order to secure a pallium, which would alleviate Bishop of St. Andrews to an archbishopric. Thurston soon arrived in Rome himself, as did the Archbishop of Canterbury, William de Corbin, and both presumably opposed David's request. David, however, gained the support of King Henry, and the Archbishop of York agreed to a year's postponement of the issue and to consecrate Robert of Scone without making an issue of subordination. York's claims over the bishops north of the Forth were in practice abandoned for the rest of David's reign, although York maintained her more credible claims over Glasgow. The Archbishop of York's claims over Scotland were rooted deeply in history. It's essential to note that these claims date back to the 7th century, and by the time of David I's reign in the 12th century, they were firmly entrenched. In the early 1100s, Archbishop Thomas II of York even consecrated bishops for Scotland, emphasising York's dominion. David, ever aware of the Scottish Church's dignity, resisted these impositions. In 1125, David managed to get his cleric, Robert, consecrated as Bishop of St. Andrews without swearing an oath of obedience to the Archbishop of York, a significant win for the Scottish ecclesiastical autonomy. The Bishopric of Durham, however, was a different case entirely. Durham's influence cannot be understated. Its bishop, often dubbed Prince Bishop, played a dual role, a secular leader governing the buffer region between England and Scotland, and a spiritual leader. By David's era, men like Ranulf Lambard and Hugh de Puiset had held the title, both known for their political acumen as much as their ecclesiastical roles. The Scottish independence versus York dominions, David's attempts to further Scottish ecclesiastical independence from English influence met resistance. His repeated pushes for alleviation of the bishopric of St. Andrews to an archbishopric rank would have nullified the claims of York. The 1120s saw him push this agenda fervently. However, a significant obstacle was the papacy. The popes often were keen to keep the status quo. This often meant mediating between the claims of York and the aspirations of David. A clear instance was when in 1127 the Pope issued a papal letter that upheld York's rights over the Scottish Church. Despite the early mentioned victory of having Robert consecrated without York's oversight, David faced challenges. His quest to get the bishopric of St. Andrews elevated met repeated roadblocks. The papacy, along with significant English ecclesiastical pressure, ensured that David's ambitions were stemmed. The dream of a wholly autonomous Scotland church remained unrealised during his reign. The period marked by these ecclesiastical power plays saw David navigating the complex web of politics, spiritual claims, and regional ambitions. Though he made significant strides in many areas, the shadow of York and the enduring influence of Durham ensured that the Scottish Church's complete ecclesiastical independence remained just out of reach. The notion of creating the Archbishopric of St. Andrews was an aspiration that stretched beyond just a tenure of David I. The idea to establish an archbishopric in Scotland was tied to national pride, ecclesiastical independence, as we've said, and the ambition of Scottish monarchs to have their church free from any external influences, especially from England. The role of the Pope was crucial. Pope Alexander III, reigning from 1159 to 1181 AD, was at the helm of the papacy during a significant portion of David's later reign. While David sought papal sanction for St. Andrews to be elevated, the Pope remained non-committal. Alexander, cautious of further incensing religious conflict between England and Scotland, especially given the close ties between the English Church and Rome, hesitated to act decisively. Enter stage right King Stephen of England, who reigned in England between 1135 and 1154 AD, and later King Henry II, who reigned between 1154 and 1189 AD. Yes, that King Henry II. They would have seen any movement towards ecclesiastical independence of Scotland as a direct affront to their own territorial and spiritual claims. Their influences, combined with York's consistent claims, made Rome hesitant. The idea of this independent ecclesiastical body wasn't unanimously supported even within Scotland. Dioceses like Glasgow under Bishop Jocelyn in 1174 and 1199 AD would have had their reservations about the primacy of St. Andrews. But what could have David done differently to change the outcome that ended this dispute and ended in a stalemate? Well, he could have done some targeted diplomacy in Rome. King David could have had dispatched envoys, scholars, and churchmen specifically to the papal court to champion his cause better, providing detailed dossiers of historical precedents favouring Scotland's claims. He could have strengthened ties with the continental European rulers, who had successfully established independent ecclesiastical structures that might have provided David with both the blueprint and the political backing to champion his cause more effectively. He could have worked closely with the bishops within Scotland a bit more, ensuring a united front, perhaps through synods or ecclesiastical councils more. These might have strengthened David's hand. As an intermediary measure, David might have sought special privileges for St. Andrews and other Scottish sees without necessarily trying to remove them from York's purview immediately, so a gradual approach rather than jumping straight in. In hindsight, it's clear that David's aspirations were ahead of his time. However, his groundwork, vision, and the continued efforts of his successors eventually bore fruit, when in 1472 AD, long in the future in our episodes, and also long after David's time, St. Andrew's was eventually elevated to an archbishopric, achieving the dream of an ecclesiastical independent Scotland. Reflecting upon the life and reign of David I, especially in the context of the Scottish Church, we're confronted with a monarch whose vision and determination moulded the ecclesiastical landscape of his nation. David's innovations in the church, often referred to as part of the broader Davidonian Revolution, reflected a conscientious effort to modernise, standardise, and in many ways Europeanise the religious institutions of Scotland. In hindsight, David's religious reforms are seen as transformative. The establishment of the new bishoprics, his battles for the ecclesiastical independence of Scotland from the English Church, the reorganisation of the Scottish Church in line with continental models, and his dedication to monasteries all reveal a king deeply involved in the religious affairs of his kingdom. David aimed for a dual goal: spiritual rejuvenation of his realm and assertion of Scottish independence and identity distinct from its southern neighbour. However, like any transformative leader, David's reign was not without its challenges. Disputes, both internal and external, challenged his reforms at every turn. Yet David's religious legacy, particularly in his support for monasteries and his attempts to carve an independent identity for the Scottish Church, remains a testament to his visionary leadership. These changes were not just religious. They had profound social, economic, and political ramifications, shaping Scotland for centuries to come. And with that, we wrap up today's dive into the epical reign of David I and his influence on the Scottish Church. I truly hope you found this journey both enlightening and engaging. Coming up next week, we'll traverse the hallways of power and intrigue as we explore the noble families that rose to prominence under David's shadow, dynasties that played pivotal roles in Scotland's tumultuous history. Notably, one of these families would even ascend to the Scottish throne, but more on that in our next episode. And then finally, after that episode, we will close off David I's reign. We'll discuss his later reign in his later years, how the succession went, and how David I is viewed throughout history after all the past episodes that we've covered. I am rather sad that we only have 2 episodes left of David. I've really enjoyed covering him, and he's honestly the longest monarch we've covered in the Scottish History podcast so far. But hey, we've got more kings to come, so hopefully kings such as Robert de Bruce can last about 10 episodes. Anyway, if you've enjoyed our podcast, don't forget to leave a review on your listening platform. You can always stay connected and join the conversation by following us on Twitter at the History of SC1. That is at the History of SC1. You could also join our Facebook page, the History of Scotland Podcast. I post a lot of updates on there when the next podcast is going to be released with some fancy pictures. So please do follow us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter for latest updates. I would also like to thank everyone for the latest reviews that I have read, not both on Apple but also Spotify. We are averaging a 4.8 to 4.9 rating on Spotify as the number one Scottish history podcast, which is insane. And on Apple Podcasts, it's really good to see 5-star reviews coming in. I just want to say thank you for all the good support that I'm seeing, all the people joining the Facebook page and saying they're looking forward to seeing the next episodes. It's really nice to see that people are interested in Scottish history, especially when told in this chronological order. Anyway, remember our episodes drop weekly, so mark your calendars for our next release. Whether you're tuning in via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Podbean, we appreciate your company nevertheless. Also, stay tuned for an updated episode 2 and 3 of the History of Scotland podcast, where I'm going to redo the episode with a better script and microphone. That should be done by the end of October, so stay tuned for that. I will mention it in the episode, the latest episode, when that is complete. Anyway, have a great week, guys. Stay safe. Enjoy the weather if it's good by you, or if it's terrible rain like it is now in England. Regardless, stay safe, have a great one, and I'll catch you all on the next episode. Peace, guys.